Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Labor and Employment Law Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, April 7th, 2017, during a live teleform conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's teleform conference call, as today we talk about the EEOC, alleged age discrimination, and employer recruiting on college campuses. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and General Counsel, Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome Eric S. Dryband. He is a partner at Jones Day right here in Washington, D.C. He's been involved in litigation that concerns our topic today, so be aware of that. He's going to talk and give us some opening remarks and background for 10 to 15 minutes, and then we'll have some questions, including questions from the audience, so be thinking of those questions for when we get to that portion of the program. With that, Eric Dryband, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Dean, and thank you, everyone, for taking the time to listen to Dean and myself talk about this issue. The upshot here is that the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission enforces the Age Discrimination in Employment Act, and the EEOC has taken the position that college recruiting programs and other hiring programs that express a preference for students or recent graduates or people with less than a certain number of years of experience are presumptively illegal. So when an employer decides that it's going to recruit entry-level accountants or managers or lawyers or engineers or salespeople or whoever from a college campus, from a university, from a law school, from a medical school, et cetera, or recent graduates, the EEOC takes the position that that kind of practice is presumptively illegal under the disparate impact provisions of the Age Discrimination Employment Act, which means that it is presumptively illegal even if there is no intent to discriminate. That is, it's unintentional discrimination according to the EEOC. No court of appeals has accepted that position. In fact, all have rejected it. Nevertheless, the EEOC remains of the view that it is right and the court of appeals are wrong, and that despite long-standing practices throughout the United States in the labor markets, where employers have routinely recruited on college campuses, have reserved entry-level sales and management and other types of jobs for recent graduates, that this kind of practice is presumptively illegal. And the EEOC now is investigating many, many employers throughout the United States for this kind of practice. First, though, I think it would help if I gave a little bit of background of why the EEOC feels as it does. First, in 1964, Congress enacted the Civil Rights Act, and with respect to age discrimination, it decided not to do anything other than commission the Secretary of Labor to do a report and study the question, which the then Secretary of Labor, Willard Wirtz, did. Secretary Wirtz issued a report in 1965 in which he concluded that age discrimination was a problem, but that there were certain kinds of unintended certain types of practices in the United States that had unintended consequences of limiting opportunities for older workers. Some of those required coercive correction, others non-coercive remedies, that is, remedies not backed by the force of law. So Congress enacted the statute, and the disparate impact provision of the statute came into existence in 1967 and is the same today as it was then. It explicitly covers employees and those whose status as an employee is protected. It does not extend protections to applicants for employment, unlike other provisions of the Age Discrimination Employment Act and unlike the parallel provision of Title VII of the Civil Rights Act upon which it was modeled. Starting around the early 1980s, law reviews started to notice these textual differences between both Title VII and the Age Discrimination Employment Act and pointed out that the provision of Title VII that addresses disparate impact claims expressly applies to applicants for employment, but that the parallel provision of the Age Discrimination Employment Act does not. As a result, then, as the matters began being litigated throughout the United States, three circuits during the 1990s concluded that these differences between Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, which protects against race and other forms of discrimination, And the Age Discrimination Employment Act meant that Title VII applies to applicants in disparate impact cases, and that there's no such thing as a failure to hire disparate impact age discrimination cases. First, in a case called EEOC versus Francis Parker Schools, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit concluded that because of the differences between Title VII and the Age Discrimination Employment Act, that the age law omits from its coverage applicants for employment. 2 years later, the Eighth Circuit followed and held that Section 4A2 of the Age Discrimination Employment Act, that is the disparate impact provision of the statute, governs employer conduct with respect to employees only, while the parallel provision of Title VII protects employees or applicants for employment. Therefore, there's no such claim under the statute. 1996, that same year, the Tenth Circuit, in a case called Ellis versus United Airlines, came to the same view. And I thought, and I think many people thought, the issue was settled. Then the Fifth Circuit in 2003 adopted that same reading, said applicants for employment are not covered under the disparate impact provision of the Age Discrimination Employment Act in a case called Smith versus City of Jackson, Mississippi. The Supreme Court of the United States affirmed on that question, although it did not reach the question specifically about applicants for employment. Nevertheless, in 2005, the Supreme Court in the Smith case determined that there is a cause of action for disparate impact claims under the Age Discrimination Employment Act, but that the cause of action is more narrow than Title VII due to textual differences between the two statutes. Justice Scalia issued a concurring opinion in that case in which he expressed skepticism that applicants can bring a claim, suggested that they cannot, and three justices, Justice O'Connor, Kennedy, and Thomas, expressly reached the question about applicants and concluded that applicants cannot in any way bring a disparate impact hiring claim under the age law. After the Smith case came down, the EEOC continued its litigation program despite what I thought was well-settled law at that point, sued Allstate Insurance Company for disparate impact claims of various sorts. And in the course of that litigation, the district court and an Eighth Circuit panel concluded that there is no such thing as a disparate impact hiring claim. Nevertheless, the EEOC remained undeterred. And in a case called Villarreal versus R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company, the EEOC began an investigation, and ultimately a private plaintiff, Mr. Villarreal, Richard Villarreal, filed a lawsuit in which he alleged, among other things, that R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company violated the Age Discrimination Employment Act when it limited entry-level manager sales jobs to recent college graduates. The district court agreed with all of the other courts to reach the question and dismissed Mr. Villarreal's disparate impact claim. Ultimately, the case went to the 11th Circuit. By a 2-1 decision, a three-judge panel reversed the district court and became the first court ever to conclude that Mr. Villarreal or any plaintiff can bring a failure to hire disparate impact age discrimination. The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission filed an amicus brief in the 11th Circuit before the panel in which it argued that the statute permits such claims, that all other courts are wrong, and that a regulation the EEOC issued in 2012 that addresses an affirmative defense under the statute, in fact, clarifies any ambiguity in the statute, and that the court should defer to the EEOC's reading of its own regulation to find that there is such a thing as a disparate impact age discrimination hiring claim. Two judges agreed, one strongly dissented. The 11th Circuit then vacated the panel opinion, and in a decision that issued in October 2016, affirmed the district court and concluded by an 8-3 vote that there is no such thing as a failure to hire a disparate impact claim. The plaintiffs in the case then filed a petition for a writ of certiorari, which is currently pending before the Supreme Court of the United States, with the respondent's brief, R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company's brief, due in late May with respect to the cert petition pending there. So that's, I think, Dean, that's kind of a quick overview of the issues. But what I think is interesting here is that the EEOC remains of the view that the 11th Circuit en banc decision and the decisions by the other courts are wrong. More recently, about a month ago, a district court in San Francisco issued a decision in which it agreed with the dissenting opinion in the Villarreal case, in a case called Rabin versus PricewaterhouseCoopers. And in that case, the district court concluded that, in fact, the Age Discrimination Employment Act does authorize a failure to hire claim. So we'll see what happens in that case, the Rabin versus Pricewaterhouse case. The defendant is seeking certification for an interlocutory appeal to the Court of Appeals, but the district court in that case has not ruled on their petition for interlocutory review. There is one other case that I'm aware of that is pending on this issue, in a case called Kleber versus Care Fusion. A judge in the Northern District of Illinois agreed with the defendant that a preference for recent graduates is not actionable as a disparate impact claim. It could be actionable as a disparate treatment or intentional discrimination claim, but not for a disparate impact claim under the existing case law. That case is now pending before the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit. Briefing schedule underway. I would suspect that the Seventh Circuit will issue a decision probably sometime early next year, but you know, could be a little bit earlier, but the briefs haven't even been filed yet. And so that's where the state of the law is right now. And with that, Dean, I'll just turn it back to you.
Terrific. Thank you for that overview. I've got a handful of questions myself, but before I start in, let me see what's on the mind of the audience here and try and get them involved. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question for our expert, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Once again, if you have a question, we're speaking with Eric Dryband, a partner of Jones Day, about the EEOC and alleged age discrimination, disparate impact age discrimination. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Our next scheduled telephone conference call, a bit of a commercial announcement here, is Monday at noon. Ironically, perhaps, the topic of that call is making the administrative state more accountable. I don't want to tip my hand here, Eric, but this seems like an administrative agency that's going a little bit out of its way. You mentioned other circuits, and the EEOC is persisting here. Can you talk about the results of this exact sort of allegation, disparate impact based on college recruiting in other circuits?
Yeah. As I say, the other circuits have uniformly agreed with the 11th Circuit, those that have considered the question at least.
How many circuits does that
apply? Five circuits. So we have decisions by the 5th Circuit, the 7th Circuit, the 8th Circuit, the 10th Circuit, and the 11th Circuit most recently in the Villarreal case. Now, I think what the EEOC says is two things. One, all the circuits are wrong, and they're right. And two, the EEOC says that four of the five circuits predate the 2005 decision in the Smith case, which is true. But nothing in the 2005 case was a decision by the Supreme Court of the United States in which that court recognized that there can be such a thing as a disparate impact claim generally. In the Smith case, the plaintiffs were employees who were challenging a pay scheme by the defendant employer. And the court essentially said, well, you can bring a disparate impact age discrimination claim, but the scope of liability is very narrow, and the textual differences between Title VII and the Age Discrimination Employment Act are relevant to this analysis. So since the Smith case came down in 2005, an Eighth Circuit panel agreed with the pre-Smith decisions that there is no such thing as a failure to hire disparate impact age discrimination. That joined, as I say, the opinions of the Seventh Circuit, the Fifth Circuit, an earlier Eighth Circuit decision, and the Tenth Circuit. But then that case was settled, and the Eighth Circuit panel decision was vacated. So the 11th Circuit decision is the only post-Smith decision by a court of appeals, but it's consistent with everything that predates the Smith case. And my own view is that nothing in the Smith opinion by the Supreme Court in any way undermines the validity of the circuit court decisions that came before it. But the circuits have been uniform. And in fact, until the Villarreal case, no judge had ever suggested that there could be such a thing as a disparate impact failure to hire age discrimination case. All of the other circuit court opinions were unanimous decisions, and they were decisions that were simply following what district courts had done. So it wasn't until the panel decision in the Villarreal case, when two of the three judges on that panel concluded that all existing law was wrong, that even a single judge had suggested that a hiring claim with no intent to discriminate was a viable claim under the Age Discrimination Employment Act.
So, again, if you're in the audience, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are open. We've got one question pending, but let me ask a follow-up before we go to our first caller, and that is, are there any allegations here that anybody's making about the good faith on the part of the government? And part two of that question is, do you anticipate, this might be an unfair question, but would you anticipate a change in the posture of the government given the change in the administration and the recent election? And I guess this is maybe a third part of the question. Does this happen often where a government brings a very similar case in one circuit after another, while after continually suffering defeats?
All those are excellent questions. Let me start with the good faith question. No one has, at least publicly, accused the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission of bad faith in what it's done in both its investigations and the litigation of these cases that I'm aware of. On the other hand, I do think that there one could draw inferences of bad faith for a couple of reasons here. Number one, the government itself and maintains hiring practices that are very similar to and materially identical to those that it now says are presumptively illegal. The EEOC itself, for example, has long maintained an attorney honors program where it expresses a preference for recent law school graduates. The same thing is true to this day at the U.S. Department of Justice and at the U.S. Department of Labor, among other places, where the government expressly says publicly on its websites, in its application materials, that those programs are limited to recent law school graduates for its attorney honors programs. I don't see how anyone could draw a good faith inference from a government that says that what it does is perfectly okay and what private employers do the same thing and presumptively illegal, especially when the courts have been so uniform in finding that the practice is quite legal and that there's no such cause of action, particularly given the statutory text, which is limited to employees and does not encompass applicants for employment, unlike Title VII of the Civil Rights Act.
So and I take it. Let me, if I could interrupt just briefly. I take it there's no carve out here for government agencies the way that sometimes there's a carve out for Congress from some statutes and some laws.
Well, there are slightly different statutory provisions that apply to government practices than private sector employees, but they're not materially different on this question. And in fact, the provisions of the statute say that that apply to the federal government say that there should be no discrimination on the basis of age in any kind of government employment decision. Arguably, is a stronger case against the government than there is against private sector employers on whether or not you can bring such a hiring claim. So the language is a little bit different, but the government has never suggested that the differences in the text somehow suggest different treatment. And in fact, as I say, to the extent there are differences, they favor private employers here and not the government. But nevertheless, the government's position has been, the government, I should say, in this case, limited to the EEOC because it's the only agency that enforces the Age Discrimination Employment Act. Its position has been that these practices are presumptively illegal. On the question, Dean, your second question of whether or not I anticipate a change in interpretation of the statute by the new administration, I think it's, you know, we don't know yet, and I can't say for sure. On the other hand, the government's interpretation here to me is so tenuous and so unsupported by all existing case law and by the statute that I think there's a very strong chance that the government will change its position on this, and in fact, I think the government should change its position. Whether it will do that, of course, remains to be seen. But I do want to add one point about this. In 2012, the EEOC issued a new regulation. It went through notice and comment rulemaking, and it purported to define the contours of an affirmative defense that's available under the Age Discrimination Employment Act, known as the reasonable factor other than age defense. That is, if something has a disparate impact that disproportionately impacts older workers, it may still be legal if the employer can satisfy this reasonable factor other than age defense. That defense is contained in Section 4F of the statute. The prohibitions of the statute are in Section 4A. When the EEOC promulgated this regulation, it did not cite or say anything about the scope of the prohibitions of the statute. That is, it did not address whether or not Section 4A applies to applicants for employment. Rather, its entire focus was on this affirmative defense, reasonable factor other than age defense. Then, in the Villarreal case, that came 3 years later in 2015 when the government first filed its brief, the government, the EEOC, that is, argued for the first time that this 2012 regulation, in fact, was an interpretation of Section 4A of the prohibitions, and that it was obvious because there is a passing reference in the regulation to individuals that the statute and its regulation must apply to all individuals on the planet Earth. The U.S. Court of Appeals, the 11th Circuit, rejected that claim and that argument. I find it implausible, personally, because it's rather implausible to think that an agency that never notified the public that it was considering whether or not hiring claims were actionable without an intent to discriminate cannot credibly say, in my view at least, that in an amicus brief it files years after the fact that a regulation, in fact, addresses something that it says nothing about. But that's what the government argued in that case, and I think and hope at least that the new administration will take another look at that. One other point too, Dean, on this question that I think I should add is I think we should remember here that these cases are being litigated in front of federal judges at the district court level, at the Court of Appeals, and even now cert petition pending in the Supreme Court of the United States. Nearly every federal judge in the country hires its law clerks who are recent graduates. It's very rare that any judge would hire for the first time a law clerk who is 10 or 20 or 30 years out of law school. I'm not aware of any judge doing it. I clerked on the Seventh Circuit. All the judges there hired recent law graduates. And it's rather bizarre to me that the government is now essentially arguing to these same federal judges that what they're doing is presumptively illegal, as well as what these defendants are doing. So I think we'll see what happens in the new administration. And I think your final question, Dean, was something about, you know, does this happen often that the government...
Yeah, are there other instances where agencies are bringing lawsuits or using the same position in different circuits and continually losing, yet clinging to that idea from one circuit to the next to the next?
Yeah, you know, that's a good question. It's more of an administrative law question, but yeah, I mean, there are agencies who take the position that unless and until the Supreme Court of the United States definitively answers a question, that what the courts of appeals say are not particularly relevant to their work. The National Labor Relations Board, for example, will take that position and does take that position. And even the EEOC itself has on occasion taken the position that it's not even bound by the Supreme Court of the United States. It's taken that position with respect to arbitration provisions, for example, when in 1997 it issued a policy statement that mandatory pre-dispute arbitration of employment discrimination claims are illegal, even though in 1991 the Supreme Court of the United States said they're illegal. The EEOC acknowledged that, said it was not persuaded by the Supreme Court of the United States. That's a little bit extreme in my experience, but with respect to the courts of appeals, the EEOC, I think, views itself as not limited by what the courts of appeals have said, and we'll see if and when the Supreme Court considers the question whether that would change their views or not. I would normally think that the executive branch of the government feels itself bound by the Supreme Court of the United States. But here, I think, Dean, the EEOC remains totally unconvinced by the Court of Appeals decisions. It's continuing its investigations throughout the United States of many employers who recruit on college campuses, recruit at medical schools or law schools or dental schools or business schools for entry-level type employment and regards all the courts as wrong. And I think unless and until the leadership at the EEOC decides to change course, then I think the EEOC will continue along this path. Now, having said that, I should add, right now the EEOC is headed by an acting chair designated by President Trump. She's in an acting capacity, but she doesn't control litigation. The general counsel position is vacant, awaiting a nominee from the White House, and that position is being held by a career lawyer who I think will continue this course until the new administration installs and the Senate confirms its own general counsel. At the commissioner level there are three Democrats and one Republican. So the one Republican is the acting chair, but she can't really change the agenda given that she's outnumbered 3-1 like that. So I think we may see a continuation of this for a while, and we'll see what happens when the new administration gets its people in place.
If you're in the audience, you'd like to join the conversation, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got one caller who's been waiting patiently for a little while, so let's check in with our first caller of the day.
Hi, Eric. Thank you for a great introduction and coverage of this issue. I have a couple of quick questions. One is I'm wondering what it would be the significance of a provision with the ADAE as opposed to Title VII. All these cases that has gone under the ADAE, what would be the practical or maybe the precedent value of not bringing them under the ADAE and bringing them under Title VII? That's one question. Also, we're assuming that we are still under the age law, and assuming that the desperate impact is not a violation of the applicant right, don't you think that bringing the new and young employees as an applicant would somehow affect the employment conditions of the existing employees, meaning that when the employer is hiring new employees, whether lawfully or unlawfully, but there's going to be somehow the new blood into the vein is going to affect the older employees? And then the last question is regarding the Rowan case in Northern California. Do you believe that the court's decision on that case somehow impacted by California law that covers both employees and applicants under the FEHA? Thank you so much.
Okay. Let me make sure I understood all three of those questions. On the first question, if I understood it, the question was what's the difference or what could they bring these claims under Title VII and not the Age Discrimination Employment Act? I think there are differences between those two statutes. The Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 generally prohibits discrimination in employment because of race, color, sex, national origin, and religion. And whereas the Age Discrimination Employment Act prohibits generally discrimination in employment because of age. So they generally protect different categories, different traits of race versus age, for example. The statutory text between the two of them with respect to disparate impact claims is different also in multiple ways. I think it's relevant to this question, the question about applicants. The statutory text is different because Title VII's disparate impact provision applies expressly and explicitly and unambiguously to both employees and applicants for employment. The Age Discrimination Employment Act's disparate impact provision is worded exactly the same as Title VII's, except with respect to the protected categories, and Title VII being race and the other forms, and the age discrimination law, of course, applying only to age. And the other difference is that where Title VII says employees or applicants for employment, the parallel provision of the Age Discrimination Employment Act applies only to employees. And so that's why, in general, the courts have said that these textual differences between the two statutes matter and that there are differences in the scope of of the claims and that Congress did not intend to authorize a hiring claim by applicants for employment. On the question about whether or not bringing in, you know, young workers could affect existing employees, I view that as more of a labor relations concern than a legal question. But, you know, I think it depends on the context and the place of employment in particular. There can be places where the older workers may feel, and may feel sometimes correctly, that the employer is phasing them out or discriminating against them because of their age in favor of younger workers who it's bringing into the workplace. And that may be actionable and may be unlawful if there's an intent to discriminate because of age, or if there is some other practice that is having a disparate impact on the current employees. The Supreme Court has clearly said that current existing employees can bring a disparate impact claim in narrow circumstances, admittedly. But in terms of a labor relations question, I agree with the caller that it could be demoralizing, dispiriting to older workers if they feel or perceive correctly that an employer is essentially transitioning its workforce from older to younger workers. That can vary, though, by place of employment. If, for example, in the medical profession, it's very common that residents and are recent medical school graduates. They typically graduate from medical school, enter some type of work/training program as an intern or resident in their area of medicine that they intend to devote their professional careers to, and most of those medical school graduates are younger, and they're mostly working with older doctors. I'm just giving that more by way of example, but it can vary. On the question of the California case, the case at issue, the district court case, a case called Rabin versus Price Waterhouse, and in that case, the district court followed the dissent in the Villarreal case and concluded that the plaintiff could state a plausible claim for disparate impact, failure to hire claims in an age discrimination case. In that case, though, the only issue that the district court decided was under federal law. It did not consider any question under California law. And so I do not think that anything about California law impacted the district court in that opinion. And by the way, to Dean's earlier question, I suppose the EEOC can say plausibly that at least one judge and three dissenting judges in the Villarreal case have agreed with them, so that their position must be in good faith, even though all the circuit courts that have considered the question have disagreed with them.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've still got some time left. To your point about Eric, about the government and the EEOC hiring, I just want to underscore that recruiting on college campuses. That when I first heard about this matter, I mentioned it to my son, who's a student in college. And on that very day, he told me that the CIA had been on campus recruiting from his college. So, and I know that, I mean, the military is a big recruiter of college age people, obviously, and they have ROTC programs specifically designed for college. So I don't know if those fall within this trap or not. But let me ask a question. I guess it might be more generally about disparate impact, just to make sure I understand this. I mean, the way I understand it is it could be a hiring policy that results in the hiring of some disproportionate protected class, or the hiring of people who that prevents the hiring of people who are in a protected class. I guess a question I have is, if there's a nonprofit organization, say here in Washington, D.C., and they're looking to hire folks at more of an administrative sort of entry-level position, they offer a certain salary. I mean, does the mere offering of an entry-level salary amount to disparate impact age discrimination, because you're going to get applications that are, you know, 90% of them or 95% of them are going to be college-level folks, people who are just graduating from college or have graduated from college in the last 2 or 3 years. As a result, for those entry-level positions, you're probably going to be hiring, disproportionately speaking, younger people. Is that a problem under this this policy?
Well, it's a good question. I don't think it is, because I don't think there is such a thing as a disparate impact age discrimination hiring claim. On the other hand, the EEOC disagrees with my personal opinion on this question, and they're the agency charged with enforcing the law. Now, so let me clarify how disparate impact works. So basically, a plaintiff or the government, in this case the EEOC, would have to identify a specific employment practice that adversely impacts, as you say correctly, some protected group of people, and there's no requirement that this adverse impact be intended to impact these people. It's essentially an unintentional violation of the law, because the effect of a particular practice is to disadvantage some group of people. That's generally the structure of it. So to your question, I think in general, I think it would be very difficult for a plaintiff or the EEOC to prove a violation of the law if an employer said that its entry-level positions were compensated at a modest wage rate, even if that wage rate attracted younger workers in general. So the first question would be, did the employer offer this lower wage rate because it intended to discriminate against older workers? The answer is almost certainly going to be no. It offered the lower wage rate because these are entry-level jobs and a nonprofit doesn't have a lot of money to pay people and so forth. And so that the disparate treatment or intentional discrimination claim would likely not be at issue. On the question of whether that kind of practice could be actionable as disparate impact, I think the EEOC could say possibly. Maybe it could. Their view is very different than the court's views on this, in that they could say that the offering of a lower salary could have a, quote, disparate impact on older workers. That is, it, even though it treats older workers in this regard the same as lower, but older workers are likely to seek a higher paying job relative to younger workers in general, statistically speaking, so, you know, and so forth. So they could make that argument, but I think nearly every federal court in the country would think that was an absurd argument, and would, at least at a minimum, would find that the offering of the lower salary was a, quote, reasonable factor other than age, which is an affirmative defense under the statute, and therefore there is no violation. Now, the question then, this reasonable factor other than age defense here, I think, warrants some comment in the context of how these age discrimination disparate impact claims work. The reasonable factor other than age defense is an affirmative defense in which the employer bears the burden of proof, and typically that comes after protracted discovery. So what is really going on here is that if the plaintiff can survive a motion to dismiss, they file their complaint, the defendant moves to dismiss, there's no discovery if there's no claim. But if there is at least a viable, plausible claim, then there is a good chance that the employer will be forced to undergo the cost and expense and risk of discovery. And because disparate impact cases are always class-wide, statistical-based cases, the cost of discovery can be very, very high. And so even if the employer might ultimately win the case by demonstrating and proving up this reasonable factor other than age defense, oftentimes that will require the employer to spend a lot of time and money and legal fees and expert fees and so on and so forth to get through discovery and then move for summary judgment after a year or two or three or 4 years of litigation. And that's really what's, I think, the problem with it, which is, so in short answer to your question, Dean, is I think it would be very, very likely that a court would rule in favor of the defendant under the hypothetical you presented. The problem is that the claim could end up costing the defendant an enormous amount of money if the EEOC is right about its theory that practices like the one you described are presumptively illegal, because if the EEOC is right, then they could force the defendant to endure years of an EEOC investigation as well as years of discovery and litigation.
And I take it we do have one caller question pending, so we'll get to that caller momentarily. But I take it under the EEOC's theory, is it the case that mere advertising to a college community by an employer would amount to a violation?
I'm glad you raised that, Dean, because their theory is that if you have an advertisement that says we want recent graduates for our entry-level accounting jobs or sales jobs or whatever it is, that kind of advertisement is almost certainly illegal under the EEOC's worldview. And in fact, I've had cases where employers have those kinds of advertisements. The EEOC threatens to sue them, and oftentimes employers will agree to pay money and change their advertising just to avoid a lawsuit. If that case were litigated, the chances the employer would prevail are very, very high. The problem is many companies do not want the publicity, the stigma, and the cost of litigation against the government. And so they will very often settle those cases without litigation rather than enduring, the cost and risk and reputational damage and so forth that comes with the civil rights-related lawsuit brought by the United States government. But your question is a good one because, yes, the EEOC does regard those kinds of advertisements as illegal. In fact, they have a regulation in the Code of Federal Regulations that says as much. My own view is that the regulation is invalid and wrong, and that if litigated, the EEOC would lose the case. But very few employers are willing to litigate that issue, and they oftentimes will try to find a way to just essentially settle with the EEOC without litigation by paying money and changing advertising and things like that.
Right. Interesting. I mentioned by the way, Dean, let me remind
the audience, too. I'm sorry. So the EEOC is doing this all the while they, the Justice Department, the Labor Department, are advertising their own hiring programs for recent graduates. It's unbelievable to me. Go ahead.
No, it does stun one to hear the details there and the disparity. I shouldn't use that term, but the disparity in treatment there. We do have one question pending. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Our line should be wide open after this next caller.
Hi, this is Roger Clegg with the Center for Equal Opportunity, and thanks very much, Eric, for that great presentation. I just wanted to follow up with what you've been saying the last few minutes and expand on it a little bit. The disparate impact approach leads to all kinds of anomalies and problems. And, as bad as it is in the employment area, and it's pretty awful there, it's even worse when you start applying it in areas like, housing and public accommodations and environmental law and on and on and on, all of which is done. This area, the disparate impact approach has really metastasized since it was first recognized by the courts in Briggs versus Duke Power Company, and now you see it all over the place. Just to give one example, in the housing area, a practice that is illegal in one city may be legal in another city, just depending on the varying demographics. A practice that starts out being legal may become illegal over time if the demographics shift. It may be illegal for large, if you look at racial and ethnic groups and define them broadly as Asians and Hispanics, but then if you break it down, it may have completely different results if you're comparing, Cubans versus Cambodians. It's just, one ridiculous outcome after another. And all of this can be avoided if courts would just take the, and legislators now would just insist on the disparate treatment approach. If violations are defined the way that they were originally intended to be defined, that is, treating people differently because of skin color or because of sex, then these problems, these anomalies all go away. So my question is, do you think that there is any way that we can get agencies in terms of regulations and Congress when these provisions are actually in statutes, or at least where the court has interpreted these the disparate impact approach to be in a statute to change these laws?
I think it's extremely unlikely. Let me say a couple things about that. First of all, the Supreme Court has repeatedly interpreted statutes that use, quote, because of something to include disparate impact causes of action. It did that first, as you mentioned, Roger. And by the way, Roger, thank you for attending today. It did that, as you know, in the 1971 case of Griggs versus Duke Power. It did it again in the 2005 Smith case, and then it did it a similar thing just in 2015 when it decided a case called Texas Department of Housing and Community Affairs versus Inclusive Communities Project. That was a Fair Housing Act case where the court said that there can be disparate impact claims under that statute.
On the other hand, you know, they rejected it with respect to Title VI. You know, they've said that Title VI is only a disparate treatment statute. Now, of course, whether the regulations that use the disparate impact approach under Title VI hasn't been decided yet. And they also rejected it for the original text of Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. So, you know, it's not impossible.
I agree with you in terms of what the court has done. But the problem to me here about predicting agencies is that Congress, let me back up. So I think the chances for Congress, so I agree with your assessment of the courts in general. Yes, not every statute, the court has not said that every single statute is actionable as disparate impact claims. I would add one other thing. I mean, the Americans with Disabilities Act is a statute where in a case called Raytheon Company versus Hernandez around 2003 or 4, somewhere in there, Justice Thomas, in majority opinion, dropped a footnote in which he said there's a disparate impact claim under that statute. So, you know, disparate impact is something that does not apply to every statute, clearly, but the Supreme Court has said that it applies to several statutes. In the Civil Rights Act of 1991, Congress expressly put disparate impact provisions into Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, and the agencies, particularly the EEOC, believe that disparate impact causes of action should be very expansive. I think, you know, the danger of expansive use of disparate impact is you get you end up degenerating into a quota-based outcomes, which the Supreme Court says that, you know, are not required, but employers and others who are trying to comply with the law and avoid class action litigation often feel that they may have no choice but simply to engage in quota-based approaches to avoid the cost and risk and everything else associated with these kind of cases. Roger, you probably know Congress better than I do in terms of trying to predict whether Congress would, by statute, amend these statutes or clarify by statute either the scope of disparate impact liability or whether or not they should be actionable at all. I haven't seen any movement in Congress under any statute that I can think of off the top of my head expressly to limit disparate impact claims. Now, I don't purport to be an expert there, so maybe you would know better than me, but I'm not seeing it, certainly not in the employment discrimination arena.
Yeah. No, I'm an incurable optimist, which probably means I'm certifiably insane. But there has been some pushback in Congress. For instance, in the run up to the Texas Communities case, majority of the House said that, I think it was maybe in an appropriations right or something like that, but they said that they were going to prohibit the Justice Department from bringing disparate impact causes of action under the Fair Housing Act. I think that, my own sense is that the public is becoming more and more aware of how ridiculous this is. And, of course, as the agencies become more and more aggressive in pushing these theories, I think it becomes easier and easier to persuade the public of how ridiculous this is. We do have a Republican majority in both houses of Congress, and we have an administration that's willing to be politically incorrect on at least some issues. So I guess my hope is that you know, where it's a matter of agency regulations, that we can persuade the Trump administration to take a new look at these regulations. For instance, you know, the regulations under Title VI, you know, as one example, and that where the disparate impact approach is in the statutes, or where the Supreme Court has said that it's in the statutes, that we can make an effort to try to get the Republican Congress to roll them back. That's my hope.
Well, only time will tell. And I, you know, one other thing I should add, I do is that Justice Scalia, about 10 years ago or thereabouts, issued an interesting separate opinion in a case called Ritchie versus DeStefano, where he, I believe it was the Ritchie's case, I'll have to
confirm it,
where he said there's at least a question as to whether disparate impact liability is consistent with the Constitution. And that was a Title VII case. Now, nobody joined him in that opinion, but he did raise it. And what I find interesting about it is that, I think what he's saying is, you know, can you have this consistent with the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, for example, or the Equal Protection component of the Fifth Amendment? And but it's a rather unusual thing, because the whole doctrine was created by the Supreme Court itself in the 1971 Griggs case, Roger, that you mentioned earlier. And so it would be rather not totally unprecedented. I mean, we have Supreme Court reversals on questions like this, going from, you know, separate but equal to separate but equal being unconstitutional, for example, in the Brown versus Board of Education decision. But it was interesting to me both that Justice Scalia raised the point and that nobody joined him. So, you know, so we'll see what happens. I don't have any particular expertise in predicting what Congress will do, and so I defer to you and others on the call about that. I just from where I sit, I don't see any action in Congress to take a whole, you know, take an aggressive approach to changing the law on disparate impact. The agencies are a different question, of course. I mean, the agencies change course generally quicker than you know, statutory amendments often take years and to do. And so I don't know what the new administration will do. I certainly think in the context of the age discrimination context, I think there's a good chance that a new EEOC general counsel and a new EEOC commission, when there will be one, will and should take a look at this question, because I just think the legal support for the position is not very strong. And the almost unanimous law on the question, at least in the federal courts, is against the position the government has taken. And I think the government looks rather odd by engaging in practices itself that it's telling the rest of the country are presumptively illegal. So we'll see what happens. But, you know, hope springs eternal, I suppose.
Well, that's right. Well, again, thanks very much, Eric, you know, for the presentation. And, you know, if there's anybody in Congress out there and Teleforum land listening, or congressional staff, I certainly think that I hope they take to heart the very trenchant criticisms that you've made of this approach.
Our lines are now wide open. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. I have one final question for you, and that is, you know, you mentioned, we've talked about it at some length, the EEOC's posture in this case in one circuit after another, after another, after another. Is there anything magical about a case like this that might get resolved in the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals as opposed to some other circuit? They're sort of the recognized experts in administrative law and agency law. When do these cases have a nationwide impact, and when do they not? It's sort of interesting that some district court injunctions have a nationwide effect, but then when somebody like you has a victory in the 11th Circuit, it doesn't mean a nationwide victory.
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm sorry, was that to me or to Roger?
No, that's to you, Eric.
Okay. On the first question about the D.C. Circuit, I don't think the D.C. Circuit is likely to decide this question anytime soon, primarily because the cases have come up outside the District of Columbia, and there has not been a direct frontal attack by, say, a trade association or a private organization that would bring a case against the government. That's oftentimes how the D.C. Circuit could hear a regulatory challenge, where the claim would be brought by some trade association or anybody who would sue the government and say your regulation is invalid to the extent that it purports to mean what you say. And so I'm not aware of any such case being brought in the District of Columbia, number one. Number two, I think it's unlikely that such a case will be brought, primarily because I think most people are of the view that the issue is well settled in the courts and there's no reason to challenge something in the D.C. Circuit that, you know, five other circuits have said is perfectly legal to do and that the government is wrong. On the question of nationwide versus local, that's an interesting question. The case that the 11th Circuit decided was a nationwide, or purported to be a nationwide collective action that was seeking nationwide relief by the plaintiff. And the case is still pending, by the way. As they say, there's a cert petition pending. But having, you know, the fact that the 11th Circuit rejected the plaintiff's position, and we'll see what the Supreme Court does, of course, on the question. But that case was nationwide, and many of these types of disparate impact cases are company-wide, and if a company is a national company, can be nationwide. Now, the case in California, the Price Waterhouse case, that case is simply pending in discovery. There's no injunction pending. Rather, the district court denied the defendant's motion to dismiss the disparate impact claim. And so procedurally, the defendant now is seeking interlocutory appeal of the Ninth Circuit in that case, but discovery is ongoing, and there's no injunction pending. There are times, Dean, as you say, where district courts have entered nationwide injunctions, particularly in a regulatory challenge context, but there is no such challenge like that currently pending that I could imagine right now would result in some nationwide injunction, say, against the EEOC. That could come up, and if the right private entity wanted to, you know, sue the government here for this, but so far no such case has happened that I'm aware of anyway.
Well, very good. We've got no questions on the board here. A couple minutes left. Let me give you a chance to wrap up or express a final thought you might have.
Well, thank you, Dean, and thank you, everyone, for taking the time to join us today. I think this is an important issue, especially for employers. And I think if employers find themselves, you know, embroiled in an EEOC investigation that challenges this or in litigation, I think it would help to be aware of where the case law is and to understand that that these practices are very common and very ubiquitous and not generally subject to being found unlawful by the federal courts. And so employers should and will, I think, continue to assess, you know, how to proceed here, because employers, many employers, you know, need, you know, entry-level people, and they find that using college hiring programs and similar programs are a way to get them. And I think employers will have to make a decision about whether to abandon such practices because the EEOC thinks they're presumptively illegal, or to continue them because they have a business to run. And so I encourage all of them to give that some thought if they find themselves ensnared in this morass of the EEOC's enforcement efforts to date. Now, and the other thing I would say is I would encourage everyone to pay attention to whether or not the EEOC changes course on this, and generally, of course, where the courts are going to go. My own view is the courts will continue where they've been on this, and we'll see what the EEOC does, though.
So stay tuned, sounds like, is the final message.
Yeah, I guess I think so.
Maybe we will have you back, hopefully, on a call in the future with some news of what's transpired at the Supreme Court. My thanks and the thanks of the Federal Society to Eric Drybend, Jones Day partner here in D.C., for this Teleform conference call. We certainly appreciate you taking the time to address our audience. I want to thank that audience as well for dialing in and for your questions. A reminder to the audience about our next scheduled Teleform conference call. That's Monday at noon at this same number. Monday at noon Eastern time. We'll be talking about making the administrative state more accountable. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.